Tom Brady amongst the NFL draft or something. So help us understand that transition from paramilitary to case.
I had no training from the agency going into the Nicaragua program. None. I got some briefings from analysts about what to expect and this, that, and the other, but there was no training whatsoever. So the transition to, the point is, I had no idea what the agency really did. And you hit on something that a lot of people do not understand. In my business, in our business, unless you're there to do a rendition or something, the minute you grab your gun, your mission's over. Our missions, even if the mission it was accomplished, you bugged that terrorist safe house. But then you get into a firefight, your mission is compromised. Your government is embarrassed, and you're PNG'd from a third country. So that is, for us, tradecraft and awareness are our tools. You know, awareness beats fast draw every single time. Because the main job is to be, you know, to detect something and be able to avoid it. So that subtlety of the program was something that fascinated me. And of course, I had read a lot. I was a reader since middle school. I had one teacher that really infected me with reading. So I was always reading about the French Resistance and about the OSS and that kind of stuff. So I understood that there was both sides of the coin, that there was a very physical, aggressive part. And I think that's why I was so well suited for it, because I really felt at home in both camps.
In the book, you outline your respect and reverence for Bill Casey. You say he's the best leader of intelligence since Wild Bill Donovan. I find Casey such an interesting figure for a whole variety of reasons, but tell me why you hold him in such high regard. Is it his leadership style, or is it his actions, or is it something else?
It's one of the highlights of my stay down there. First of all, I mean, you got to understand, I was a GS-10. And here I am, I get called in from the camps, no reason given. My colonel said, we need you to come in, Alex. And I show up at our command post, and there is this guy in pressed vest with really nice clothing on and Rolex, big cigar in his hand, and said, and I was introduced to Dewey Claridge. Who was a legendary and man, one of the wonderful friend. He was a mentor of mine from that day on. And I will tell you, I still get goosebumps because, you know, all of a sudden he introduces me to Bill Casey and he says, Mr. Director, this is your man in the camps. And you talk about a badge of honor. I was, you know, and then Casey says to me, he says, son, you know those photographs that you take in all the camps and you send in? I keep those on my desk. And anytime somebody tries to push back against this program, I use those photos to beat them over the bed, over the forehead, keep them coming. So, I mean, I was walking on air. I had the pleasure, although it was difficult, because I had the best Spanish of the guys there, when we had a couple of meetings with the Honduran, senior Hondurans, and some of the Argentines that were there at the time early on. I was his interpreter. And as you probably have heard, he was always a mumbler. And so I'm sitting there, we're at this one training camp, not one of the operational camps, but one of the training camps just outside of Tegucigalpa. And my food, of course, was getting cold, it had flies on it. I couldn't eat, I was paying attention. And all of a sudden, he kind of like does one of these and closes his eyes. And I go, oh boy, this is going to be something. And there was this Argentine that was kind of noticing what was going on. So he started pressing. And Bill Casey just all of a sudden looked up and gave him the most precise, articulate answer. And the guy went like, oops. I think the other thing that fascinated about him was that he was an OSSer. He wasn't a guy that parachuted into France, but he conceptualized a lot of great operations and he did a lot of great stuff. And again, there's a common theme here. They're believers. Casey was a believer. Dewey Claridge was a believer. Colonel Array was a believer. Vietnam vet, the whole nine yards. To tell you the truth, this is the reason I wrote the book. Because, you know, my agency is the most maligned, misunderstood agency in the whole federal system. We're always being painted as being immoral, corrupt, maniacal assassins, American Made and Jason Bourne and all these movies that are out there. There is very few movies or books that portray the agency in a realistic light. We don't do the James Bond stuff. Yes, sometimes you get into trouble and you fight your way out, but it is a completely different thing than what people expect from us. And people don't realize that our successes cannot be recounted. I mean, the Nicaragua stuff, I can talk about it now because that was 1980. How many years have gone through that, that I am now being allowed to talk about some of these things? I really wanted to be the voice of my colleagues as much as possible because, you know, you mentioned when I first walked into that hall. When I saw those stars on the wall, that's a chilling effect because, you know, the agency is not big in numbers when it comes to operational officers. And, you know, sadly now, Andrew, there's 137 stars on that wall, and a third of them are post-9/11. I would say that the successful operators in the agency, they're not looking for a job. They're looking for a purpose.
Just when you were talking about Casey there, I'm sure you've heard this one, but the joke was that they didn't need a telephone scrambler for him because
nobody could understand it.
I'm sure some people say the same thing about me.
I could understand it clearly, so we're good.
Okay, so let's walk forward then. So you've made the transition over to a case officer. So we've got this period when you make the transition from, and you go back and forward, but you make a transition from fighting communists to fighting terrorists. And it's quite interesting because that in the book you outlined that one of the jobs that you went for, you later found out that you were the only person that applied because at the time the agent counterterrorism was the bastard child of the CIA. Tell us a little bit more about that transition over to counterterrorism.
Again, it was one of my bosses that came to me and said, "This is a perfect job for you. We need to have more case officers that have paramilitary credentials. We need to get our guys to be recognized," and they are. They definitely are, especially now. So I put in for this job, and I waited like 3 weeks, and, you know, I'm sweating it. And finally, the guy that our PEMS officers, is a personnel officer, calls me in. And he was kind of a jerk anyway. He calls me in, and he says, "Okay, yeah, you got the job." And I go, I did like a high five or whatever. And he says, "What are you so excited about? You were the only guy who applied for the job." And I'm not saying that, that place, as you read, was very dangerous at the time, but that was probably the most dangerous time in that country's history up to date, as far as, you know, the insurgencies and the terrorism and the murders and the sabotages that were being done. So people, you know, it discounted a lot of people, a lot of people with families did not want to go there. The other one was the language. You know, my agency moves with this language, you know, that is our key trait. If you cannot communicate, you cannot recruit, or you cannot develop, and you cannot recruit. Quite a pleasant surprise, and I never told my wife that the guy told me this was that I was the only guy who had applied. I know better than that. So,
help us understand that transition for you personally, but also for the agency that you loved this. Move over to counterterrorism because you play such an interesting role because your mentor, Dewey Claridge, he becomes the first head of the counterterrorism center. And then you later on become the chief of operations. Help us understand that gradual transition through the 90s over to the early 2000s, where the agency and you both start pivoting towards counterterrorism.
You know, counterterrorism was probably one of the biggest game changers for the agency, because most of our work was done in the diplomatic or the business circuit, recruiting foreign agents with access to intelligence, but in very socially acceptable, areas and over dinners. And, well, you cannot get terrorism information or counter-narcotics information from somebody in the dip circuit. So it was a new set of skills, which it really helped a lot of the paramilitary officers, because now you had individuals that had a little different grit, and I think that was an advantage. But that was such a big deal, and I've heard the charges that, you know, we as an intelligence community took our eyes off the communist ball, and thus omnifocused on terrorism, and I disagree, because I know that we were still working against the Soviets and against the Chinese and against the North Koreans. However, I will say that it was a triage of resources. You know, a terrorism is the equivalent of getting shot, where communism is the equivalent of cancer. So if to fight either one, at least with the cancer, you have some medical and you have some paths that you may be able to take. And most importantly, you got a little bit of time. In terrorism, if you miss the cues and you lose the timing, people die. So that we had to do a triage kind of concept of what is most important with the finite resources that we all had.
How much were you focused on whatever was in front of you, the task at hand, and how much were you thinking about what was over the horizon? I know that, help us understand how much someone like you, who's rising through the ranks, who's doing this transition, how much are you focused on what's in front of you, and how much space or time do you have to take a step back and look at the bigger picture?
I think it's an excellent question. I think it's a combination. You know, in the agency, you don't get anywhere if you're just a blunt instrument. It's a career of sophisticated complications. You know, you have to understand that, you know, intelligence operations, you know, you're talking exhaustive collection, exhaustive intel analysis, you're talking meticulous planning, and then you're talking expert execution. Those are things that are very hard to achieve if you're a one-trick pony. We always kept in the big picture as part of our education and as part of our training at the farm, is understanding that you have to know the global dynamics and how that affects your account. That said, as you so properly said, when you're there, tunnel vision, you are focusing on your stuff. And in that one Latin American country, I remember the first thing I used to do every single morning, I used to get into the office before 7, grab a cup of coffee, and I would take the left-wing newspaper, the right-wing newspaper, in the middle of the road newspaper, and I wouldn't even turn on my communications until I had read through those, because I needed to know in whatever microcosm was what was going on. So I think that it's again the characteristics of an agency officer or an intel officer is more of a jack of all trades than an expert. You know, I think that our analysts, for example, are the most incredible. I mean, I love our analysts. We couldn't do our work without them. They have the luxury of coming in and picking a topic, and they can carry that topic for their whole career. And I know a guy, we EOD together, enter duty together, and he literally went from GS 10 or 11 to an SISer doing the same kind of work, just more and more sophisticated and more knowledgeable, where we have to go to different countries, learn different languages, learn different customs. For me, the transition to terrorism was heaven sent, because I still like that part of it. I mean, I've done the other. I've done some great recruitments of diplomatic circuit individuals, and I do own a tuxedo to this day, so I clean up well. But deep in my heart, I like getting my hands dirty, and I like meeting folks. And that period in Latin America where I was literally, I literally recruited a terrorist through coercion, but nonetheless, it was something that it was easy in my character to say, hey, this is justifiable, and of course, we had the permissions to do so. It was an easier transition than somebody that was used to, you know, Paris or something like that, and all of a sudden now they're being sent to a place where it is a third world and people are trying to kill you.
Another thing that I find quite interesting is it seems to me from the book that you, a lot of your work is South or Central America and then in East Asia, Korea, also North Africa, sorry. So there's quite a lot of ground that you cover. I guess the question is, for many people, like, you find your niche, you stick to the niche because it reaffirms your sense of self-worth because you're the person that knows about that niche. So that seems to be the more typical thing, not just for people in intelligence, but just in life. But for someone like you, to go from PJ to paramilitary to case officer, from Latin America to Korea to Shangri-La, there's a lot of lateral moves. There's a lot of adaptations and chameleon-like behavior, and I mean that in the best possible way. For people that are listening, like, how does one go about doing that? Because typically you just find the thing that you are comfortable with, you stick to that because it makes you feel secure, and then you don't move.
Perhaps I just have a short attention span and have to all of a sudden find, you know, I've conquered this, I got to go do something else. You know, our officers seldom do more than 3 years in country because of exposure and just wear and tear. So you are going to be moving from different accounts and different cultures to a certain degree. For me, it came easy just because I wanted to go where the average person wasn't going. That was always my niche. Shangri-La was a perfect example. I was 4 years into my SIS rank when COFR said, hey, you know, I need you to get me somebody to go to Shangri-La and help us, you know, with the station that was just reopening. The embassy had been closed for a couple of years, I believe. And I couldn't find anybody. I made a bunch of phone calls to all the personnel officers, and they all said, no, we don't have anybody that's interested. And for several reasons, one was my wife did have a medical scare there when we were in Korea. And also because our kids were now of school age, they were in high school, different grades in high school, we decided we were not going to take any further overseas tours, that I would, you know, continue to do my work, but do it more from headquarters and TDYs. And so when I went to my wife with the fact that I said, look, I want to do this, it's going to be probably 6 to 8 months. She's a trooper. I mean, I couldn't have done anything that I did in my career without her. And you read that in the book. She even participated in some pretty cool adventures. But it was that change came natural, just chasing what was the highlight topic. And there's also, I think I included in the book, is that I didn't do any career planning. I never sat there and said, you know, I need to get this job in order to get my GS 13, 14, 15, or SIS. I always followed I hate to use the word the action, but where the importance of the pointy end of the spear needed to be. And there's two or three incidents in the book where those changes came to me. I wasn't looking for them. I was chief of the Koreas, and that's how I made senior grade. And I was the rep to the NSC for the agency on that hard targets board. And it was a great conventional job. I loved it. Again, fighting communism. Very sophisticated. I got involved in operations because I like to lead from the front. And that's in the book. At least one of them was they allowed me to talk about. But, you know, I had Hank Crumpton, who to this day is a dear friend of mine. He called me up, and I had never met the man. I had heard of him, and he says, I want to talk to you. And he's the one that I went over, so we chatted over coffee, and he said, look, you know, I want you to be my replacement in a year. And I wasn't thinking of going back to the center at the time. So all of a sudden, I find myself back at the center as the chief of international terrorism, which was everything except Bin Laden. And then from there, moving to going to Shangri-La, and coming back as the chief of ops, and then being the chief of ops when 9/11 actually happened. It's very similar to what happened to me in going to Costa Rica and going to Korea. It was the chief of station that had asked for me. In both those incidents, for different reasons, they had asked for me to be pitched to do that. And there were both surprising changes because in both cases, I was supposed to already assigned to another country. And at the last minute, you get this phone call that says, come here, the chief wants to talk to you. And I end up in these other two assignments, which were absolutely wonderful, but they weren't of my picking. Yeah, it was my, my mentors or leaders saying, that's a good fit for him.
That certainly comes across in the book. Like it wasn't a chess match of trying to get as far up the hierarchy as you could get. It was more, where is the action on the chessboard? That's where I want to be.
Yeah. I think that the greater majority of the agency folks, and you know, you got to understand, and you know this, the agency is not just operators. The guys who are ops officers, case officers, is a finite number. We cannot do anything without the support of everybody else, from logistics to security, from our analysts. It is a team sport. And each one of those individuals goes into that career track, logistics, security, whatever it is, but you do it through the agency because you believe in it. You believe that you're trying to make a bigger difference. So whether a DO officer or a DI officer or a DA officer, I found that the majority of the people that I worked with were mission-oriented. Whatever their mission was, mission-oriented. They were proud and they were very focused on making sure that they kept their end of whatever needed to be in operation. That said, like in any culture, I mean, in the military, you have guys who go in and, you know, the Billy Waz of the world that go into harm's way for four tours in a row and have eight Purple Hearts. And then you have the other ones that, you know, gravitate towards the circuit and become military attachés, and they all end up at the same place, but by different means. I was blessed with opportunities that allowed me to polish myself and to grow. And each one of these tours, because they were so different, when you come out of there, you have a different level of confidence because now you've conquered yet another culture or another challenging things or working at a different kind of a target.
Let's go forward to September the 10th, 2001. I think that's quite interesting because you're there at the counterterrorism center. News has came through about Ahmed Shah Massoud, who's been assassinated by Al-Qaeda operatives. In the book, you outline how you're thinking to yourself, this is pretty sophisticated the way that they've done this. It seems like something else is happening. Take us back to that day, September the 10th. Help us understand what it was like to be Rick Prado on September the 10th, 2001.
You know, to paint you a better picture, I will start with again, one of these jobs that I was asked to take that I didn't even know existed, which was I'm a plank owner of the Bin Laden Task Force. Mike Scheuer, a brilliant analyst, was the chief of the station, and I was the deputy chief of station. That was my first exposure to what became Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and everything else. So I had that knowledge behind me of their modus operandi. And the one thing that I learned really early on in counterterrorism, especially when it comes to the Al-Qaeda type of terrorism, is the guys who pulled off 9/11 had enough education to fly a 747 into a building. Killing Massoud was one of the most clinical operations anybody could tell. They went in there into the hornet's nest in that kind of dedication. So you cannot underestimate your enemy if you want to win your fights. So 9/11, I was like every single one of us, we know exactly where we were standing and what we were doing. And I knew there was something bigger. As soon as that second plane hit, my first comments to the chief of staff was, I need you to send out a cable to every station telling them, number one, watch your six. This is not a singleton act. And number two, turn up every rock because we need to know who these guys are and where their softer belly buttons are at. That was my very first action. As you probably know, the agency was forced to evacuate because there was other planes, and they felt that the agency was a viable target. I mean, I would have hit it first, knowing what I know, but I guess they went for the political part of it or the economic and impact. But CTC stayed open. The counterterrorist center stayed open. Kofor Black, who to this day is one of my dearest friends and mentor, he said, I'm not going anywhere. You're all free to go. And especially if you have kids who came out of school and all that other, you're free to go. But the counterterrorist center stayed open. I slept in my office for 3 nights without going home, literally taking showers in the gym. And one of my favorite stories of that period, and I use it to show the contrast from what the media portrays are people like to the reality of the courage and conviction that my colleagues display every single day. It was around 8 o'clock at night on 9/11. And I was making the rounds because, you know, CTC was a huge open area with gazillion cubicles. And I walk up to the area where Hezbollah branch was because my office was on the other side. And there was this young lady that was sitting at the desk. She was the deputy of the Hezbollah branch. She was 8 months pregnant. And I walked up to her and I said, what are you doing here? And she says, well, I'm not convinced that this was bin Laden. I want to make sure that it wasn't Hezbollah. Well, let's face it. Hezbollah had killed more Americans, 246 of them, as a matter of fact, before 9/11. They had killed more Americans than anybody else. And I looked at her and I said, look, I've delivered 2 kids in my life. None of them were mine. I ain't about to do the third. So I forced her to go home. I had one of our logistics guys take her home that night. I saw her again a few years later, and she came to me and she said, you know, every birthday that my daughter has, I think of you because you forced me to get out of there. And the moral of the story is the strongest drive in the human race is the mother instinct to protect her child. And this woman, 8 months pregnant, was able to turn that off and stay in harm's way to get her job done.
And there's a really beautiful vignette at the end of the book where you discuss Joey Claridge phones you up and said, you need to come. And you go and the two of you sit and you have this moment where you realize that he's passing the torch on to you. I was wondering, have you thought to yourself, who's the person that I'm going to pass the torch on to? Joey?
I already have, actually.
You already have? Can you tell us who?
Yeah, I cannot mention it by name. My old deputy, for one, in that last effort that ended up being extremely high rank in the agency, he was a guy that was always smarter than I was and just as good as anything as I was. I would consider him like one of the two or three people that I actually mentored and passed on the baton inside the agency and even afterwards. My deal with Dewey was actually helping him post my agency career. I was still working with the community. This is outside of the book, so I cannot go into details. But for the next 8 years after retirement, I did nothing different than run programs for the community in a very different way. And Dewey, that was one of the things he wanted me to take over, was some of these great thing connectivities that he had here and there. And it ended up being really sexy things to run. But it was never a career thing. It was always a purpose. And, you know, I made some mistakes as a lot of young guys would do by being kind of a jerk, getting into fights and crap. But, you know, I believe that we can build enough good karma that it will get us to the right afterlife, as far as I'm concerned. And for me, it was always that mission. For me, it was the purifying fire. For me, was the agency and pararescue. I'm very proud, very, very proud. I would have not gotten into the agency if it had not been for pararescue.
It's been so great to speak to you. I could speak to you all night. Just to bring it to a close, I think there's another really beautiful vignette at the beginning of the book, which I alluded to earlier. You're 7 years old. You're looking out of the window and you see this gorilla on your front porch firing into a bar that policemen used to frequent. And then your journey to be where you are now. And I guess the question is, have you been back to Cuba? Is there still that part of you inside that still longs to go home? Or do you feel like you've moved on now? And help me understand.
You know, Cuba is my roots. That's my cultural roots. That's my family roots. I'm very proud of being Cuban born. I'm an American, first and foremost. That I have an affinity towards Cuba, of course, because that's home. You're giving me more credit probably that is deserved in that sense. I mean, I didn't plan any of this. These things just were things that came in my way, and I had to walk some, and the other ones I chose to walk. But it is not that unique. I will tell you, I have a very good friend of mine. I will not mention his name because I can't, but agency guy, that's how he retired from the agency, senior grade. But he was in the Bay of Pigs as a 17-year-old. He turned 18 in a Cuban jail. When Kennedy extricated them through the trade of tractors and medicines, he joined the Green Berets and he went to Vietnam and he had tours in Vietnam. Then he came back and he went to Georgetown, got his degree, and then joined the agency and had a fantastic career and retired at SIS something. So organizations like the agency have a lot of Rick Prados. We will never have a shortage of warriors. We could do better in leadership, but we'll never have a shortage of people that are willing to go in harm's way. And that was the fascinating thing for me in working with the CIA was that if I looked right or left, I saw people that I admired. Some junior to me, some senior to me, some of my peers, but were people that I was extremely, extremely proud to be part of. And again, that's why I'm writing the book, because I want the average American to see what a real CIA operation looks like. Not Jason Bourne, not James Bond, as many books of his as I read. That's not what we do. I'm still waiting for my Austin Martin. we don't. He was a Scot, right? And so,
come to the Spy Museum. We have one in the lobby.
I know. I might drive it off. but it was that trajectory that being seen the amount of talent and conviction and patriotism that all my peers display day in and day out was humbling. Very rewarding career.
I think that's one of the things that, in a humble way, I'm trying to do with the podcast is to humanize intelligence professionals. You know, they're regular folks in some senses, but extraordinary folks in other senses. That's one of the humble goals I have for the podcast, just to try to get these stories out there.
And I truly appreciate your time on this and your effort on this, because it's very important to me. You know, when my grandson was born and I was starting to read, I said, I don't want him to learn about the agency from the movies. So it's great. Well, and the next time that we talk, I will tell you my Scottish story when I went to MI6. That's exactly what happened. The Scot guy that was my counterpart taught me how to drink single malt scotch and was just getting into cigars, and I taught him about cigars, so why not do it again with another good Scot?
Let's do it. Thanks so much for your time, Rick. It's been really a pleasure to speak to you. I've enjoyed it very much, and I really loved your book, and I hope it does gangbusters and everybody hears about your incredible story.
Look forward to meeting you in person. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spycast. Go to our webpage where you can find links to further resources, detailed show notes, and full transcripts. We have over 500 episodes in our back catalogue for you to explore. Please follow the show on Twitter at @INTLSpycast and share your favourite quotes and insights, or start a conversation. If you have any additional feedback, please email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. I'm your host, Dr. Andrew Hammond, and you can connect with me on LinkedIn or follow me on Twitter at Spy Historian. This show is brought to you from the home of the world's preeminent collection of intelligence and espionage-related artifacts, the International Spy Museum. The Spycast team includes Mike Mincy and Memphis Vaughn III. See you for next week's show.
Sensiz asla olmayacağım. Her zaman içimde kalacaksın sen. Bak şuramda, tam yüreğimde. Oysa senin kalbin başka ellerde. Bu kalbim sahipsiz kaldı öyle. İstesem de olamam ki başka biriyle. Öylesine bir sevgiydi ki bu. Alışamadım inan, çok zor, ne olacak şimdi. Yalnızım tek başıma, alışamam yokluğuna. Artık yoksun yanımda, gel de ağlama. Yalnızım tek başıma, alışamam yokluğuna. Artık yoksun yanımda, gel de ağlama. Sen de olamam ki başka biriyle. Öylesine bir sevgiydi ki bu. Alışamadım inan, çok zor, ne olacak şimdi. Yalnızım tek başıma, alışamam yokluğuna. Artık yoksun yanımda, gel de ağlama. Yalnızım tek başıma, alışamam yokluğuna. Artık yoksun yanımda, gel de ağlama. Yalnızım tek başıma, kalbim olmuş paramparça. Beni böyle sen bitirdin, git yoluna.
Sensiz bu hayat inan biter. Yalnızım yokluğun elinden beter. Love you many times and now you are gone.
Ein Plätzchen für mein Schätzchen. Cannabis in Holland, Mama, die auf der Venus. Boy, wanna go to Africa, to the black jar, Rastaman, to the black culture. Have a nice love, Africa. Alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone, alone
Min yetne esmetek ma ahata ma alsut Metehe en soharato ya bana amduy Min yetne esmelzen he en baro mne Metehe en soharato hatarana aduy Menet nehesh metegma ahadama alshut Medeche en sohrato yabanam doy
My game was strong and my money was long I really made this business pay. Everything was going exactly the way it was supposed to.
The world is changing. I call down the gods and they call me home. Problem nowadays is that they done lost their goddamn minds. You can teach a man to fish, but does he really just eat to fuck to die? Coddled by mechanical instruments impending his peaceful slumber. Half chicken, half swine, Mr. Policeman. Goddamn, I can blow the 7-9 to smithereens in a fedayeen type scenario. In my America, choosing a busy pedestrian through way to maintain your daily running regimen is punished punitively. Fingers removed in homage to Yahoka One Thought Form God. Again and again, children, young jits, fully integrated into the digital, have tick-tick events and take their life in order to preserve their avatar. It's a terrifying world, and I'm just living in it. I didn't build it, it's not my responsibility. But maybe we can all join hands and sing down the fire to burn the schools to the ground. We can all be cavemen and graze in the golden grass like buffalo in the somber setting sun. Save yourself, drown your inner child in the bathtub, throw in a toaster and maybe a tambourine. I know it ain't greasy, baby, but this is the fucking American dream.
Dat is het. Mijn leven is voorbij. Ik was getrouwd, we waren aan het bouwen. Ik dacht dat wij aan het bouwen waren. Het viel me op dat mijn man eigenlijk met de bouw getrouwd was. Zijn hobby was veranderd in aannemers zoeken, een plakker, elektricien, loodgieter, alsof hij ze aan het sparen was. Gotta catch 'em all. Dus ik dacht, ik zoek ook een hobby. Iets dat ik kan. Kunnen is misschien een groot woord, maar ik ben beginnen shotten. Die eerste trainingen waren fantastisch. Zon, frisse lucht, nieuwe vriendinnen. Zei ik vriendinnen? Ik bedoel natuurlijk dames. Veel dames. En toen kwam het moment dat we moesten douchen. Samen. En dat is uiteraard naakt. Aha, dat is dus team spirit. Iedereen chill. En ik sta daar mijn best te doen om niet naar de borstenparade te kijken. Ik voelde mij een ramtoerist. Je mag niet kijken, maar het is heel moeilijk om dat niet te doen. En dan keek er iemand naar mij. Niet zomaar iemand, een vrouw. En ze lachte naar mij zoals nog nooit iemand naar mij lachte. Zonder dat ik daarvoor eerst bakstenen moest mengen. En ik dacht, oei oei, nu is het om zeep. Ik zat op vakantie met mijn man en ik dacht alleen maar, zou ze nu al gestuurd hebben? Mijn man zei, amai, dat is lang geleden dat we nog zo genoten hebben. En ik, ja ja, heeft hij nu al gestuurd? Mijn vriendinnen, ben je zeker dat je niet verliefd bent? Ik, heel serieus, nee, dat is geen verliefdheid. Dat is codependentie. Code wat? Een app om te daten? Nee, Dat is een ding dat je je eigen gevoelens opzij zet voor de ander. Eigenlijk, ik weet niet wat ik wil, dus doe wat jij wilt. En toen besefte ik ben een puber. Maar dan in met een hypotheek. Maar nee hoor, ik val niet op vrouwen. Ik had gewoon nood aan aandacht. Aandacht van een specifieke vrouw, die mij eigenlijk superleuk vindt. Dat is geen verliefdheid. Dat is gewoon shotten. Heel intens shotten. En zo ben ik dus uitgekomen. Uit de kleedkamer en uit de kast. Dank u.
Deutschlandfunk. Das Feature.
Der Edwardsee trennt den Virunga Nationalpark im Kongo vom ugandischen Queen Elizabeth Park. Die Grenze führt mitten durch den See. Ginge es nach Kongos Naturschutzgesetzen, würden sich hier am sandigen Ufer Nilpferde und Büffel suhlen und Löwen durch die umliegende Savanne schleichen. Wie in vielen afrikanischen Nationalparks dürften auch im Virunga Park keine Menschen leben. Doch hier an diesem Ufer reihen sich hölzerne Fischerboote. Männer reparieren ihre Fischernetze, Frauen sitzen auf Schemeln im Schatten einer Akazie und sortieren den Fang. Rund 700 Menschen leben im Dorf Wijumbi, illegal. Dazwischen patrouillieren bewaffnete Parkwächter. Die Wildhüter tragen Maschinengewehre, Panzerfäuste und Granatwerfer. Von Weitem hält man sie für Soldaten. Doch an ihrer Schulter prangt nicht die kongolesische Flagge, sondern ein Gorilla-Logo.
Aufrüstung im Nationalpark. Die Militarisierung des Naturschutzes in Afrika. Ein Feature von Simone Schlindwein.
Maurice Kasereka kann derzeit nicht auf den See hinausfahren. Der Fischer hockt vor einer armseligen Lehmhütte auf einem Schemel. Seine vier Kinder sind barfuß und schmutzig. Der kleinsten, sie ist vielleicht zwei, läuft gelber Rotz aus der Nase. Seine Frau rührt auf dem Holzkohleofen eine Suppe an. Fischsuppe mit Resten, was die Nachbarn übrig gelassen haben. Kasereka hält seine verbundene Hand. Sie ist geschwollen, der Mull blutig und schmutzig. Es war 3 Wochen zuvor, am 23. Mai. Ein glatter Durchschuss, der den Fischer, der sich keine ärztliche Behandlung leisten kann, wohl sein Leben lang behindern wird.
Wir sind wie jeden Morgen auf den See hinausgefahren. Dort begegneten wir 2 Milizionären auf einem Boot. Sie hatten eine Waffe. Sie haben uns als Geiseln genommen. Dann kamen Patrouillenboote der Parkbehörde ICCN vorbei. Wir dachten, sie würden uns retten, doch sie fingen an zu schießen. Zuerst 4 Kugeln. Unsere Geiselnehmer haben die Schüsse erwidert. Eine Kugel hat einen Parkwächter erwischt. Daraufhin haben die Parkwächter unser Boot mit Kugeln vollgepumpt. Ich bin ins Wasser gefallen. Ich wurde in die Hand getroffen. Ich kann von Glück sagen, dass sie mich gerettet haben.
Immer wieder kommt es zu solchen Vorfällen. Natalus Makuta zeigt entlang der Hauptstraße auf 2 frische Gräber. Auf den Holzkreuzen stehen die Namen von 2 jungen Fischern. Gestorben am 28. November 2018. Der Anwalt dokumentiert diese Vorfälle für Kongos Umwelt- und Menschenrechtsorganisation Credo. Makuta ist ein alter, grauhaariger, kleiner Mann. Er ist hier aufgewachsen.
Alors, ce qui concerne le conflit entre ICCN.
Der Konflikt zwischen der Naturschutzbehörde ICCN und der Bevölkerung geht historisch auf eine unklare Gesetzeslage zurück. Die Menschen in Wichumbi stammen aus 11 Gemeinden, die bei der Gründung des Parks 1925 umgesiedelt wurden. Deren Dörfer lagen inmitten des Parks. Um irgendwo zu überleben, haben sie sich hier niedergelassen. Vorher lebten sie vor allem von der Jagd, doch dann fanden sie sich plötzlich hier am See wieder.
Seitdem leben sie vom Fischfang, denn laut Gesetz dürfen innerhalb des Parks weder Jagd noch Ackerbau betrieben werden. Doch nun sinken die Fischbestände und die Naturschutzbehörde ICCN will deshalb auch die Fischerei unterbinden. Die Parkbehörde erlaubt ihnen nur einen gewissen Bereich zum Fischen. Einige Fischer haben dagegen eine Miliz gegründet, sich bewaffnet und fischen jetzt illegal. Die Dorfbewohner fühlen sich sowohl der Miliz als auch der Parkverwaltung ausgeliefert. Es ist ein Leben wie auf einer Insel. Am Dorfeingang, wo die einzige Straße durch den Park vorbeiführt, sind bewaffnete Ranger postiert. Sie kontrollieren alles, was nach Wichumbi hinein und hinaus geht.
D'abord le parc ne veut pas que la population reste ici dans ce milieu. Et maintenant la population dit comment? Maintenant vous pouvez nous remettre là où nous étions.
Eigentlich will die Parkverwaltung nicht, dass die Menschen hier in der Gegend bleiben. Jetzt sagen viele Leute, schickt uns doch zurück in unsere alten Dörfer. Es gibt eh keinen Ort, wo wir noch leben könnten. Niemand darf hier ein Haus bauen. Wer bauen oder nur renovieren will, braucht eine Genehmigung der Parkverwaltung.
Die Häuser sind verfallen. Sie stammen noch aus der Kolonialzeit. Bei vielen ist das Dach eingebrochen. In der Regenzeit nässt es durch. Doch sobald ein Lastwagen mit Ziegelsteinen, Zement oder Wellblechen durch die Kontrolle am Dorfeingang will, werde er von den Rangern beschlagnahmt. Dann sei im November 2018, inmitten der heißen Wahlkampfzeit, der Provinzgouverneur nach Wichumbi gekommen.
Le gouverneur a dit que quand même là où il y a un être vivant, quand même il doit avoir un logement quand même un peu passable.
Der Gouverneur hat gesagt, ihr habt ein Recht auf Wohnung, das Recht, Häuser zu bauen und zu reparieren. Aber trotz dieser Entscheidung des Gouverneurs hält sich die Parkverwaltung nicht daran. Darum waren die Menschen unzufrieden und haben daraufhin eine Demonstration gegen den ICCN organisiert. Das war im November 2018.
Die beiden Gräber entlang der Hauptstraße. Das sind die Toten dieser Demonstration.
À ce jour-là, c'était les enfants. Les élèves voulaient d'abord que l'ICCN respecte l'ordre du gouverneur.